Truth Seekers, how you doing? Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. This is too much weirdness flooded into the Malloy email box today. I mean, just crazy stuff. Crazy stuff. You know, I look at this stuff, and there's a new one I'll get to maybe this evening. U.S. military is teaching its officers so-called Hiroshima tactics for total war on Islam. It's from Common Dreams. It's not from some goofy site. It's from Common Dreams. I could even tell you the guy leading the class, Army Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Dooley. We'll get to that a little bit later. In about half an hour, Gene Ross, who is a registered nurse and a member of the Council of Presidents with National Nurses United, is going to be on because we're going to talk about some fascism that Rahm Emanuel is working against the National Nurses United for the upcoming NATO conference in Chicago. We'll tell you about that. It's just too much, man. Too much. There's a whole ton of other things too. But anyway, let me just tell you, the entire evening tonight is sponsored by Sam McKee. Thank you, Sam. This first hour, his message: before becoming a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War, Scott Ainsley was a celebrated musician, troubadour, and mentor. He introduced me to Noam Chomsky in 1971. His music and scholarship are inspirational. Go to Scott's website, cattailmusic.com. Cattailmusic, one word, .com. There's two T's in that, by the way. Cattailmusic.com. Enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey. All 3 hours sponsored by Sam in L.A. tonight. Plow through the hard times and stand our ground against the psycho bullies. Thanks, Mike and Kathy, for all that you do. If you're listening online, you will hear Scott Ainsley's music. We're playing from his website, from cattailmusic.com, tonight, if you're listening online. To get some silliness out of the way, I guess it's silliness, actually it's scary, an American couple of Middle Eastern descent were asked to leave a JetBlue plane sitting on the tarmac in Florida. They were traveling with their 18-month-old daughter, and she, the 18-month-old daughter, is on a no-fly list. The incident happened Tuesday night in Fort Lauderdale as the family was getting ready to fly home to New Jersey. A JetBlue employee told them they'd have to leave the plane and that an agent for the Transportation Security Administration, TSA, wanted to speak with them. Little girl's mother said, the employee said, well, it's not you or your husband. Your daughter was flagged as no fly. 18 months old. She told the TV station WBPF, WPBF, I guess it's Palm Beach. She told the television station, quote, the whole situation was bizarre. It made absolutely no sense, end quote. They were allowed to reboard the plane about 30 minutes later, but they refused, saying they were too embarrassed to fly on the airline. The couple's little girl, Rihanna, has flown several times and even has her own little frequent flyer card. That's like Molly has her own little wings from AirTran. Your parents asked they not be identified. All three members of the family are U.S. citizens and were born and raised in New Jersey. Little girl's father says he thinks they were targeted because the family is of Middle Eastern descent and his wife wears a headscarf. The father, husband, said, quote, "We were humiliated, we were embarrassed, we were picked on," end quote. The airline said TSA was responsible for the incident. TSA said the airline was to blame. Both JetBlue and the TSA said they're investigating. I don't give a damn who's responsible. An 18-month-old child winds up on a no-fly list. And, I mean, how much education do you have to have? How old do you have to be? How much maturity do you have to have to look at that situation and say, no, I don't think this little toddler is really a terrorist. I just don't think so. So I'm going to ignore the fact that this little girl's name is on a no-fly list. I mean, what the hell is wrong with people? My God. 18-month-old child. She doesn't talk yet, right? Kathy, do they talk? They don't talk at 18 months. Do they? A little bit? And the other goofy, half-assed story for tonight is about Mitt Romney, of course. An in-depth examination of Romney's teenage years at Cranbrook School in Michigan. I've been there. I went there. The Cranbrook Art Institute, I guess it's connected to Cranbrook School. The Cranbrook Art Institute, I had a friend who got a scholarship there, and I went up one time to visit her. And the statuary, the artwork there is just gorgeous. Unbelievable. It's outside Pontiac, Michigan, I think, if I remember. But I digress. Mitt Romney, he went to Cranbrook School, and according to the Washington Post, Mitt Romney was a real little bastard, a little bullying bastard, especially against the one little boy who, not little boy, I mean, they were all teenagers, who may or may not have been gay. It doesn't make any difference what his sexual orientation was. Mitt Romney and his bullying buddies treated the kid as though he were the object of bullying because he happened to be gay. The Washington Post attributes the story to five former fellow students. They say that Romney led a pack of students at the institution, Cranbrook School. They, among other things, in this one instance, they brought a student down, cut off his long blonde hair as he screamed for help. Of course, Romney says he don't remember any. He doesn't remember any of it. I don't remember any of that. No, not me. What time is it? Where do I go? Hey, hi, how you doing? Would you like a cup of coffee? You know, I saved the auto industry here in Michigan. This guy is a crazy son of a bitch. Isn't he insane? The five students who went to school with him referred to it as a vicious attack. So do you hold somebody accountable for something that happened 45 years ago? You're damn right you do. You're damn right you do. A spokeswoman for Mr. Romney told the Post, Washington Post, that, quote, anyone who knows Mitt Romney knows that he doesn't have a mean-spirited bone in his body. These stories of 50 years ago seem exaggerated and off base. And Governor Romney has no memory of participating in these incidents. No memory. It wasn't just grabbing this kid and knocking him around and whacking off his hair. There's more. Romney added he didn't, in addition to not recalling the episode, he said that whatever happened, it wasn't fueled by any kind of negative feelings because of the kid's sexual orientation. Oh, really, Mitt? Really? You don't remember it, but if it did happen, it had nothing to do with the fact the kid might have been gay. That seems a little... Oh, wait a minute. I'm talking about Romney. I almost said that seems a little illogical, but this is Mitt Romney.
George W. Bush will give a country a push. Put us back on the road to what's right and true. George W. Bush is gonna give us a push. He's the man who lives.
We're just kidding with the Bush thing.
He's the voice inside your head. It's Mike Malone.
21 past the hour. So it doesn't matter how much of a prick Mitt Romney was when he went to the exclusive prep school, Cranbrook. The Washington Post article also describes another episode in which Romney mistreated a mostly blind teacher at the Cranbrook School. In that episode, students recall that Romney purposely guided the blind teacher, who they called the Bat, into a closed door. The Post wrote, quote, Romney giggled hysterically as the teacher shrugged it off as just another of life's indignities. The article goes on, the most searing images were of Romney's treatment of John Lauber, who the Post said came out to his family and close friends as gay later in life after being expelled from Cranbrook. The Post called five former students, four by name, who said they witnessed Romney, quote, marching out of his own room ahead of a prep school posse, shouting about their plan to cut Lauber's hair. One of the boys followed them to a nearby room where they came upon Lauber, tackled him, pinned him to the ground. As Lauber, his eyes filling with tears, screamed for help, Romney repeatedly clipped his hair with a pair of scissors. The Post added, quote, it happened very quickly, and to this day it troubles me, said Thomas Buford, the school's wrestling champion, who said he joined Romney in restraining Lauber. Isn't it funny that the school's wrestling champion remembers this? But of course Mitt Romney doesn't, oh no! The wrestling champ, Thomas Buford, subsequently apologized to Lauber, who was, according to Buford, terrified. Okay, does it matter? Nah, of course not. But if you remember that famous quote, probably apocryphal, but the quote anyway, the Duke of Wellington, after he kicked Napoleon's ass at the Battle of Waterloo, remember what he said? The Battle of Waterloo was won on the playing fields of Eton. Meaning, of course, not Sandridge, Eton. I don't even know if Sandridge was around then. But because the boys used to do things on the playing fields of Eton, the public school, I guess they refer to it in Britain, although it's, we would call it a private school. So, does it matter that Mitt Romney, apparently, in addition to being a total liar, in addition to being a hypocrite, in addition to being a weasel, a worm who will say anything to a bunch of knuckle-draggers in order to get the nomination, in addition to all that in his adult years, and being a liar, and trying to take credit for other people's decisions, like the decision to save the American auto industry. In addition to all that, this man was a gay basher, a bully, and someone who, in a very cold way, abused one of his own teachers who was blind. Now, all of this ought to endear him to the right-wingers. You know, the right-wingers aren't sure about Romney because, you know, he's just doesn't seem to be a lot like them. Well, right-wingers, this is your man. He's a liar. He's a bully. He picks on gay people. He picks on people who are physically challenged. This is right up your alley. This is your boy. Love him. Love him. Vote for him. What do you mean Romney is not conservative enough? All of that stuff is conservatism, as you clown bastards define it now. This is your boy. He lies. He cheats. He steals. He fires people. He rips things to pieces. He beats up on folks if he's in a mob. That is so right wing. There's not a right winger out there has the courage to go one on one, mano a mano with somebody. No, 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 no. Let me join a mob, a posse. Where do I get my insignia? Where's my armband? How do I give the salute? You bunch of freaks. Jesus God. So just a quick note to you right wingers. Don't be running around acting like Mitt Romney's not your boy. Get behind this guy. He's a religious freak like you are, and you know he claims that you know they're all Christians. He's a religious freak. He's a bully. He murders jobs. He closes plants. He throws people on the street. This is your guy, right-wingers. This is your man. Celebrate him.
A family work.
Just had another cup of coffee. Here's Mike Malloy.
Indeed, 25 before the hour. This hour being sponsored by Sam McKee, as the entire night is. He wants you to go to Scott, Scott Ainsley's website, and it's cattailmusic.com, and enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey. All 3 hours sponsored by Sam in L.A. tonight. And Sam says, plow through the hard times and stand our ground against the psycho bullies. Thanks, Mike and Kathy, for all you do. Thanks a lot, Sam. I appreciate it. Let me tell you a little bit about Jean Ross, who is RNBSN. She is an acute care nurse, member of the National Nurses United Council of Presidents. She grew up in the suburbs of Minneapolis and worked at the same medical center, Fairview Southdale Hospital, for 35 years. She got active in the Nurses Association in that state in the wake of the nurses strike in 1984. That's when 6,000 Twin Cities area nurses took to the picket lines to defend seniority rights. She went on to hold the position of chief steward at her hospital for 20 years. In 2001, she helped lead a strike of Fairview nurses that achieved landmark contract language, allowing nurses, and this is very important, to close a unit to new patients when it was too understaffed for them to provide care. Don't forget that so many hospitals are profit-making centers like everything else in the U.S. So the nurses decided for the sake of clinical care, decent clinical care, that they would not overload themselves where they could not take care of the patients. She also serves as a board delegate for the Coalition of Labor Union Women. She holds a BSN from the College of St. Teresa. Hi, Jean. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And one thing I didn't add, National Nurses United, and we've had a couple members of your organization on over the past year. It's the country's largest union and professional organization of registered nurses. It has 150,000 members nationwide. I was looking at this article from the Chicago Tribune, Gene, about Rahm Emanuel all of a sudden is apparently afraid of a demonstration of nurses that has been in the works for, I understand, for months, in protest of the NATO meeting that is going to occur in Chicago. What's Emanuel afraid of?
Well, that's a very good question, the way he's treating this whole thing in the city of Chicago along with him. It appears they think we seem to be some sort of a security threat.
Nurses.
Nurses, yes, exactly. We have, as you said, had this set up all along for months, and we were going to do, and still are, a march to culminate at Daley Plaza on May 18th. Mm-hmm. We have so much support. We've been garnering it all along. Nurses from all around the world, actually, not just our members. And you're correct. I would just say one more thing about what you said earlier. We actually have now, because of our organizing, about 170,000 mm-hmm. nurses around the country, and we are the largest direct care nurse organization. There are others that have nurses in education and management, but we are direct care nurses, all of us. So we received a letter Tuesday. And said that the city of Chicago, now that they found out we'd actually been encouraging people to show up and leafleting and emailing, and we have Tom Morello from mm-hmm. Rage Against the Machine playing a number or two in support of us, mm-hmm. that we couldn't possibly have just 1,000 or 2,000 people. They've determined that we must have 5,000 or more, and that would be too disturbing, and it would interfere with the flow. Downtown Chicago.
You know, it's amazing to me. I lived in Chicago for 3.5 years before I moved back to Atlanta. I worked for WLS there, worked for ABC. And what was stunning to me was the right-wing attitude of media in that country and also the political class, even though they all claim to be Democrats. Chicago being one of the centers of union organizing. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the Haymarket mm-hmm. massacre.
Exactly, May 1st.
Yeah, all the labor organizing that went on in Chicago, the books that were written about organizing there, the jungle written about the meat industry there. And now Rahm Emanuel, I mean, this guy, you know, I don't want to drag this into it, but I'm going to say it anyway. He's a member of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. When he goes to Israel, he practices or he trains with the IDF. How could he be afraid of nurses? This is a part I don't get. Could it be that you folks are advocating specifically for a transaction tax on Wall Street deals to help pay for health care? Do you think that might be it?
Oh, we have no question that that's it. He's terribly afraid of the truth, and I think he's terribly afraid of the fact that people trust nurses, and they trust us to tell them the truth. So, no, we are not a threat to national security, but we are a threat to Wall Street. And he is very friendly with Wall Street, always has been.
Mm-hmm. What, you know, I've talked about this before on the program, but I want you to, in case people were not listening that night, what is or why is the National Nurses United, why is that union in favor of this? Now, transactional tax is every deal that goes down on Wall Street, is that correct?
It would be for high-speed trading. It focuses on the high-speed trading of stocks, bonds, derivative currency dealings, not consumer activity, not the average everyday you and me.
Okay.
It would be 50 cents on $100, 0.5%, and we know that it could bring in about $350 a year. And the reason...
You don't mean $350, you mean...
$350 billion. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
$350 billion.
That would certainly take care of health care in this country, wouldn't it?
Well, more than health care, you know, as nurses, we see the terrible effects of this economic hardship. and on our patients and on our families. We know that our patients, they talk to us.
Mm-hmm.
They are skipping medications. They are putting off elective surgeries. They are cutting medications in half. We can, in many cases, patch them up, but we can't even say we can send them home again because they may not have a home to go to. We see an increase in suicide rates. We see anxiety and depression in little children. This should not be our country. And so we look at what we see nobody in Congress appears to be doing, which is looking at a really valid way to pay that would not hurt most of us, as opposed to the other suggestions that they've put forward. And that's where we came up with this. 40 other countries have some form of this sales tax. We used to have it ourselves up until, I believe it was 1966. It works. We know it works. There's no reason why we shouldn't have it again.
It's a perfect way also, this so-called tax. I don't know what I would call it, because it's a tax on transactions that really are not producing anything for the American public. It's not providing jobs except for those elite derivatives traders. Some people will make the argument that this is how capital is raised for certain capitalist ventures, but to that I just say simply hog's not. So it's a perfect way to contribute to health care, the cost of health care in this country. I'm sure there are other ways. I'm in favor, and I think National Nurses United, when you get right down to it, are in favor of single payer.
Yes.
But I'm in favor of that. But until and unless that comes along, this transactional tax just makes perfect sense.
Exactly. We call it our Robin Hood tax. For obvious reasons.
Right.
And as you said, the kind of trading that they're doing not only does not contribute to the economy, it's detrimental.
Right.
And we see it as a way to pay for, when we think of single payer, we think of a new and improved Medicare for all. That's how we see it.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be not just to deal with our health care system, of which we really don't have one, but it would be to look at education, relief for foreclosures, everything that we see happening right now, as I said, to our patients and families. School closures, home foreclosures, those kinds of things, that, you know, that you're talking depression era.
Right.
And this is not where we are right now.
You know, I remember the night that, I think it was the night that Barack Obama won the presidential election, and he and his family went to Grant Park. I think it was Grant Park, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And there were, by most estimates, I heard there were 80,000, 90,000 people there.
Exactly.
And aside from that, in the time that I lived in Chicago, it was during Clinton and NATO, the war against Serbia, there were thousands. There's a huge Serbian population there, as you probably know. Thousands of people would show up almost every weekend for these demonstration marches to the to the British consulate. And somehow the city was able to cope. So,
well, they actually have us shunted over to they call it Petrillo, Banshell, and Grant Park. And our original permit was for Daly Plaza, and we are very definite on that. So when you look at the fact that they've had many, many high population demonstrations at Daly Plaza. They've had, I believe it was April of last year, they had a huge demonstration for those poor folks in Wisconsin and what Walker's been doing to them. There were about 8,000 there. Oprah Winfrey, they allowed her to shut off sections of Michigan Avenue, and they had millions of people there watching the Black Eyed Peas.
Mm-hmm.
There have been parades for victorious ball teams there that turned out thousands and thousands of people. So their reason just doesn't jive.
It does not make sense. Hold on a second, yeah. Gene, if you will. I got to do some commercials here. We'll be right back. We're talking with Gene Ross with National Nurses United. Stick around.
Always answer the call. If we care for our neighbor, care for each other, there will be care for you.
Come on, we're gonna get better, yeah. Don't run for the trees, yeah. I'm gonna find some faith. Just because you're hot and mild.
America one flying monkey at a time. Here's Mike Malloy.
This hour has been sponsored by Sam McKee. And he wants you to become familiar with Scott Ainsley, his music and scholarship, Sam writes, are inspirational. Go to Scott's website, cattailmusic.com. Enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey. Cattailmusic, one word, .com. And all 3 hours tonight, sponsored by Sam in L.A. Plow through the hard times and stand our ground against the psycho bullies. Thanks, Mike and Kathy, for all you do. Well, you're more than welcome. We're talking with Gene Ross of National Nurses United. This appearance by Tom Morello, it's astonishing to me that the city, ROM, is using that. What do they say here? Quote, the addition of your event to your event of a performance by a popular nationally known musician who regularly draws large crowds under similar circumstances, blah, 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 will increase the number of participants at your event far beyond the number estimated on your application. Morello is quoted here as saying, by the way, who grew up in Libertyville, which is a north suburban town north of Chicago. He said he's used to government agencies taking a confrontational tack with causes he supports. Morello said, quote, it's interesting to be blacklisted in my own hometown. Mm-hmm. He adds, at the same time, it's not going to stop anything we do, the number of people who come out in the streets or the songs I'm going to play, end quote. Is Morello saying then what you are saying, that this legal, constitutionally protected march will go on as planned?
It will go on if we have anything to say about it. As originally planned, we are fighting the decision to either shunt us over to the new location or cancel, because if we don't move, that's what they said they would do. So we are fighting it. But regardless, wherever we end up, we will be at our demonstration. We had this planned for so long. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but originally the G8 and NATO were both going to be meeting there.
Yes.
We normally have this kind of meeting, an event in Washington, D.C. We deliberately moved it to Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we first applied for the permit and said, you know, we are going to be demonstrating there, next thing we know, they moved the G8 meeting to Camp David, and we thought then, gee, aren't we powerful? My goodness, what are they afraid of?
Right.
And then we thought we had it licked, but Tuesday here we get this letter, and they're still afraid.
You know, it has to be, Gene, that it's not so much the march, the demonstration, the people that's showing up. It is the fact that what National Nurses United is advocating, this transactional tax, that is what will get the publicity.
Yes.
And that is what, obviously, this is what the power structure, is, in this particular case, Rahm Emanuel, is so terrified of. Because
mm-hmm.
once that is out there for debate, I think a lot of people will take a look at that and say, you know, that makes a little sense. And then they'll say, well, you know, that makes more than a little sense. That makes amazing sense.
Exactly.
I was just going to say, and the fact that this is coming from people who, nurses, who are on the front line of this sort of thing, seeing what this, what these people have done, these financial sharks have done to the middle class, have done to the working
right.
poor, so on and so forth. Who better to make this statement than you folks?
Well, that's what we figured. You know, we had about enough of, oh, my goodness, this is so bad. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Well, in the absence of somebody else doing something, I mean, it just seemed to us it was our job. This is what we do. We advocate for people. We try to heal. Well, you can't heal an economy by cutting jobs and essential services. And we find that our supporters all over the world are calling, you know, for the same thing, for an end to this stupid austerity that's making things worse.
It is. Yeah, it is. My son and his wife, well, I better not say where they live because I don't want to be harassed, but she's a lawyer. He graduated from one of the universities in the South with his BSN and his RN, and he now works in the trauma department of a major hospital in one of the cities here in the Southeast. And he's, you know, my son Chris, he's 33, and he tells me essentially the same thing. What he sees, people coming in, and of course he works in trauma medicine, so he sees the worst of the worst. But, you know, people come in with gunshot wounds or knife stabbings or horrendous car accidents or attempted suicides. And they, you know, while the nursing and the medical staff go to work, the hospital staff has to start taking financial information, and what they find, so many people that show up, as you say, they may have been at one time able to pay insurance premiums. Now they're showing up in emergency rooms with nothing.
Right.
And it's just, I think my son is getting, although he's always been kind of like me, he's, you know, way left of center, but he's starting to understand from the firsthand experience of dealing with people who are in horrific situations that something has to be done. And I think that's exactly what you folks are about.
Yes, we are.
Well, I'm hoping to hear more from Eugene when this event is over. I hope things go well, and I hope you'll take care of yourself and your cohorts when you're in Chicago.
Well, I hope things will go off as planned. If not, you know, I don't know. Maybe he didn't do his homework, but we don't give up. We certainly don't give up easily.
No.
We had a press conference on Wednesday that was very well attended by the press, and we had a lot of support from the people there. So if they were worried about crowds turning out, well, now they've got more people interested because of what they've done.
And that's the way it should be. Gene, thank you so much. Good luck and take care, okay?
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk again. Gene Ross, National Nurses United. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. City regarding Romney the Thug. Mike, from the accounts of Romney's actions, I would classify this as assault and battery as well as a hate crime if committed today. Yet the base of the Republican cult will mark this off as youthful indiscretion. But what if he were a black youth wearing a hoodie? The hypocrisy is enough to gag a maggot. Gordon in OKC. Yeah, thanks, Gordon. This hour, all night, sponsored by Sam McKee. His message, Scott Ainsley, songwriter, musician, philosopher. His music will please your ears as well as open your heart and your eyes. In the words of Stephen Foster, hard times come again no more. So go to his website, cattailmusic.com, and check him out. Enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey. cattailmusic.com. Sometimes Michael the Handsome makes me laugh really hard with his notorious wit and macabre humor as he launches volley after volley of venom at the vitriolic varieties of facile fascists and right-wing nincompoops. Is he referring to me? Good times, he says. Thank you, Sam. All right, from Prairie 2. It's a little bit long tonight, but this is a good one. You could worry about the banks or not. J.P. Morgan Chase, that is the largest of the monster banks, admitted this afternoon in taking $2 billion in losses on so-called trading over the past 6 weeks and may take, quote, additional losses, end quote, of another billion or more, according to CEO Jamie Dimon. He called it stupid mistakes. I really wish he wasn't lying. The thing is that the trading, so-called, wasn't in stocks, bonds, or even oil futures. They were trading in derivatives, perhaps credit default swaps, but reports are sketchy so far. For credit default swaps contracts to be activated on that scale would require somebody to default on a lot of debt, or at least have their credit rating downgraded. We haven't heard about anything like that. So where did this come from? Well, the most likely explanation is that they've been inflating the value of their portfolio by churning trillions in derivative contracts based on God knows what. These vampire banks do skim off the economy in general by selling credit default swaps contracts to other people with money to protect them from wild swings in the markets or from the volatility in a particular sector like oil or the economy in general. These banks are, of course, the people who are really responsible for the wild swings in the markets they are willing to insure you against. The scary thing is, J.P. Morgan was supposed to be run by the smart guys who were able to stay above the fray. The thing about crashes is that they usually start with something nobody was expecting. And this could turn out to be the mother of all bank crashes. If you don't have your canned goods, why are you still sitting there listening to this? Good, you're back. Something else you really need to get is drinking water, a few gallons of bleach, coffee filters, and a shovel. Actually, this has nothing to do with the banks. This is about fifth grade science. Remember learning that if you pass a wire through a magnetic field, it will generate electricity? Take my word for it, you really did learn that. Now, when they talk about all the sunspot activity on the news lately, you might want to pay attention. It seems that the ancients had the right idea about the sun being God. Our sun seems to be pissed off at us. Maybe we could sacrifice some Republicans. When the sun goes through an active period, it throws big chunks of itself out into space. These are multi-billion ton gobs of ionized gas, many times the size of the Earth. And when one hits us, it produces the so-called northern lights. You see, our planet's magnetic field shields us from all this ionized gas and the accompanying radiation. The problem is that if it sometimes throws out really, really big gobs, and it seems to be doing that lately, and won't even peak in this cycle until next year. If the so-called big one hits us when the Earth is turned at the right angle so that the charge of the ion cloud and the charge of our Earth's magnetic field line up, this pushes the magnetic field down to ground level. This is where the fifth grade science comes in. We would then have lots of wire passing through a very intense magnetic field as the Earth rotates through it at 1,000 miles an hour. This has happened quite a few times over the past century, knocking out localized power grids, but we had a really big one in 1859. Of course, the only long-line grid in those days was the telegraph system, and the showdown at the Western Union office was quite spectacular. We almost had to go back to the Pony Express. The National Academy of Sciences estimates that if such an occurrence on the same scale were to happen today, it has the potential of taking out the long-line electrical grids of the entire planet. We're not talking about just blowing the fuses. The real potential threat is that it could take out all the big substation transformers. It has happened before on a local basis. They estimate the recovery time, depending on how many transformers were actually destroyed, from days or weeks to 10 years. Let that sink in. 10 years. The problem is that these transformers are designed to last decades, and there aren't that many on hand. Nor do we have the ability to ramp up production quickly, even if we had electricity. And by the way, all of ours are made in China anyway. Strategic planners, those Republicans. The immediate threat to the public would be that many large municipalities don't have diesel backups for their water systems. They depend on gravity-fed tanks to keep things going in an ordinary power outage. Even if the local power plant survives, without substation transformers, there's no way to get electricity to the pumps. This is where the bleach comes in. A couple of drops will sterilize a gallon of pretty much any water, but run it through the coffee filter first to take the chunks out. The shovel? Well, sewer systems won't be working either. The shovel is also handy for burying the people who drink the bad water. Bet you aren't worried about the banks anymore. Damn. Prairie2.com. No, no, I'm not worried about the banks at all, Bruce. No, no, no. Yow. Yeah, I've kind of sort of heard about, you know, one of these massive solar ejections that he's writing about here, but I don't think anyone has put it so succinctly. I have heard, yeah, the global power grid, or at least huge, massive chunks of the power grid, various parts of the country, depending on where these outages occur, could be affected. And can you imagine, let's say, someplace like India? I mean, here with no power. But India with no power. Europe with no power. Well, any place with no power, right? And you know how a bad storm hits and your power is out, your electricity, it's knocked off for 8 hours? Boy, we just go crazy here. We've had that happen a couple of times, and we don't have the ability to transmit the program. And I've had people say, well, you need a backup generator. Yeah, yeah, I know. And diesel fuel and all that. But no thanks. Can you imagine what it would be like with no power for a year or six or 10? I wonder how long it would take us to start eating each other.
Make speeches to the wind. Count the votes that might have been. What you gonna do when the silence falls? See that cloud in the eastern sky. See that cloud in the eastern sky. Brighter than the brightest pearl. Big enough to eat this world. What you gonna do when the well runs dry?
Mike Malloy. Turn down your speakers. It'll be our secret.
21 past the hour. Okay, you know, it seems like just about every night we get some kind of horror light show, right? This is on Common Dreams today. U.S. military teaching officers so-called Hiroshima tactics for total war on Islam. Okay, listen up. The U.S. military has been teaching its future leaders that a total war against the world's 1.4 billion Muslims will be necessary to protect America from terrorists, according to documents released today in a stunning story in Wired's Danger Room. Among the chilling assertions in the document, oh, wait a minute, hundreds of U.S. military officers have enrolled in the course on Islamic radicalism since it was first offered 4 years ago at the Defense Department's Joint Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia. Among the assertions in the documents, it advocates total war against the world's Muslims. It advocates taking war to civilian populations wherever necessary. Using the lessons of Hiroshima to wipe out whole cities at once. Applying the historical precedents of Dresden, Tokyo, Hiroshima, Nagasaki to Islam's holiest cities and bringing about Mecca and Medina's destruction. By conservative estimates, 10% of the world's Muslims, a staggering 140 million people, hate everything you stand for and will never coexist with you unless you submit to Islam. This is all in the documents. International law protecting civilians in wartime are no longer relevant. Quote, we have now come to understand that there's no such thing as moderate Islam. A July 2011 presentation states, it is therefore time for the United States to make our true intentions clear. This barbaric ideology, they're referring to Islam, will no longer be tolerated. Islam must change, or we will facilitate its self-destruction. This is what Wired's Danger Room reports. The course, first reported by Danger Room last month and held at the Defense Department's Joint Forces Staff College, has since been canceled by the Pentagon brass. It's only now, however, that the details of the class have come to light. Danger Room received hundreds of pages of course material and reference documents from a source familiar with the contents of the class. The commanders, lieutenant colonels, captains, and colonels who sat in Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Dooley's classroom, listening to the inflammatory material week after week, have now moved into higher level assignments throughout the U.S. military. The officer who delivered the lecture, Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Dooley, still maintains his position at the Norfolk, Virginia College, pending an investigation. For the better part of the past decade, a small cabal of self-appointed or self-anointed counterterrorism experts has been working its way through the U.S. military, the intelligence and law enforcement communities, trying to convince whoever it could that America's real terrorist enemy wasn't Al-Qaeda, but the Islamic faith itself. In his course, Dooley brought in these anti-Muslim demagogues as guest lecturers, and he took their arguments to its final ugly conclusion. Dooley's ideological allies have repeatedly stated that mainstream Muslims are dangerous because they're violent by nature, yet only a few of Al-Qaeda's most twisted fanatics were ever caught musing about wiping out entire cities. That's what we're considering. Dooley said, quote, some of these actions offered for consideration here will not be seen as politically correct in the eyes of many. Ultimately, we can do very little in the West to decide this matter, short of waging total war. Now, among the class materials, former FBI employee John Guandolo's action items for U.S. military officers on what they can do in their own communities to fight the enemy. What you can do. Educate yourself about the true nature of the threat. Assign someone within your group to do a deep dive on this so you begin developing an internal expert on this material. Study the unusual responses document here. There's a PDF file. Begin sharing this information with close friends and selected others individually. Then in very small groups, learn from these encounters, encourage them to challenge you. Study insurgencies and counterinsurgencies. Understand that local police are the tip of the spear, and this problem will be solved by citizens at the local level. Know the ideological literature when you see it. Possession of this material may change the threshold for reasonable suspicion and probable cause for law enforcement. You know, if you own a Quran, you may be suspected. Identify key individuals in your community who are likely to be open to listening to this information. Prepare yourself. Practice. Give the presentation. Encourage them. Follow up. Identify key Muslim brothers and Muslim brothers organization in your community. Develop a small group of like-minded patriots who have studied and understand the threat. Strategize to regain control of your community. Do not over-organize. Think like the enemy. Be fluid. Do not discuss your strategy publicly. Know your allies. Well, there's more. There's more. Stick around.
Substance, no abuse.
Before the hour, this hour being sponsored, as the entire evening is, by Samuel McKee. Thanks, Sam. He wants you to listen to singer, songwriter, musician, philosopher Scott Ainsley. And Sam writes, his music will please your ears as well as open your heart and your eyes. Go to his website, cattailmusic.com. Check him out. Enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey. cattailmusic.com. And he concludes by saying, sometimes Michael the Handsome makes me laugh really hard with his notorious wit and macabre humor as he launches volley after volley of venom at the vitriolic varieties of facile fascists and right-wing nincompoops. Good times. Thanks, Sam. Back to the course that was taught to taught at Joint Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia, run by the State Department. Hundreds of U.S. military officers have been told that a total war against the world's Muslims is going to have to be fought, and that they're going to take the war to the civilian population wherever necessary, using the lessons of Hiroshima, Dresden, Tokyo, Nagasaki as their template on wiping out, ultimately, millions of people. This is some sick stuff, man. I'm telling you. Anyway, back to things you should do. Consider joining a grassroots organization locally and nationally. Those in the community who are assisting the enemy should be exposed. This can be done in a number of ways. Consider spending time recruiting, educating a member of the local media, especially a young, aggressive reporter from the local paper. Put the heat on those elected officials helping the enemy. Be aggressive. Take a crowd to a city council meeting and demand action. This is one tactic that works. Now, what they're talking about, you go to a city council meeting, the city council doesn't have any, you know, ships, planes, or cannon. But what city council can do, they can assist in setting up neighborhood watch groups to watch out for the Muslims. Well, you know what I'm talking about. The Germans did this very effectively. I should say the Nazis did this very effectively in the 30s in their own country. Push back at every turn. Do not allow any compliance with Sharia at any level. Oh, there's that again. Study the foundational principles of America, the Declaration and the Constitution. We must know the enemy and we must know ourselves. Create an education campaign for the community that stresses truth and facts. Engage your local police department and city attorney on this issue. When speaking with attorneys, ensure you keep your language focused on Islamic law and that it is diametrically opposed to Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution. Engage leaders of local churches and synagogues until it's time to turn on the synagogues. Right, boys? Initiate a relationship with a key member of your local town council, your state representative, your senator, your U.S. congressman. It's going to go slowly. Don't give them the entire block of information in one sitting. Ask them the questions. Act concerned, not over the top. Remain objective and unemotional. Be consistent. Speak to the leadership of your state National Guard about the Islamic movement. Learn what is going on at the Islamic schools and mosques in your community. Request to see the teaching materials. Attend functions at the local college when someone speaks truthfully about Islam and observe the reaction. Go to the local mosques and ask them if you can speak at Friday prayers and share the gospel with the attendees. You kind of get in the drift here. Engage your local FBI field office and ask them about the amount of training they receive on the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic doctrine, and the Islamic movement in the U.S. and across the globe. Know that if you are effective, there will be pushback from the other side. Have a team assembled. Don't go it alone. Remember to target the good guys who are helping the bad guys first. If you go after a Muslim brother to create a public issue, get help from someone with a deep level of knowledge on this and plan well. The Muslim Brotherhood has an entire machine ready to pounce on you. Don't give them the opportunity. Remember, we are at war. Act like it. You are part of a resistance movement, not a social club. Jesus, fiery Christ. You know, you wade through all of this insanity. No, this was allowed. This was the U.S. military Joint Forces Staff College in Norfolk, Virginia. And you know, as you go through this stuff, and then you get this, there's one line. Go to the local mosques and ask them if you can speak at Friday prayers and share the gospel with the attendees. What gospel? Well, there's a capital G here, so you know what gospel. Go to a mosque during Friday prayers? Can you imagine someone of the Islamic religion going to a Baptist church and saying, hey, listen, I want to come in and explain to you about Islam? How long before they would shoot him? I hate religion. Every aspect of it. And now this. But this bit here advocates total war against Muslims and bombing and burning civilian populations. You know, when they talk about using the lessons of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Tokyo, the firebombing. You remember Jimmy Doolittle's raid on Tokyo? And given the construction of Tokyo, the construction of homes and offices, but especially homes, paper, thin wood. I've read that over 50,000 people were burned alive, men, women, and children, in Tokyo during those raids. Dresden, the firebombing of Dresden. Go online and take a look at some of the film of what happened in Dresden. You know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but they're talking about firebombing Mecca and Medina. The U.S. military is telling its general staff officers about burning alive 140 million people. The class, led by Army Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Dooley, was canceled last month, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs recently ordered the military to re-examine training material to be sure no similar content exists. Lieutenant Colonel Dooley still holds his position at the Joint Forces Staff College. So they put these people through this training, over the past 4 years. All of a sudden it leaks out. Oh, no! Time to stop! Stop, 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 stop! All done. Had enough? Yeah, me too. Good Lord. Okay. Now, there's one last thing. You know who James Hansen is? He heads the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York City. He's part of the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He's held that position since 1981. He's also an adjunct professor at the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University. He's perhaps best known for his research in the field of climatology, his testimony on climate change to congressional committees in 1988. Helped raise broad awareness of global warming and his advocacy of action to avoid dangerous climate change. In recent years, Hansen has become an activist for action to mitigate the effects of climate change, which on a few occasions has led to his arrest. Do you want me to, tell you what he had to say today? He said in a lengthy article, or not lengthy, in an op-ed piece, global warming isn't a prediction. It is happening. That is why I was so troubled to read a recent interview with President Obama in Rolling Stone in which he said that Canada would exploit the oil in its vast tar sands reserves, quote, regardless of what we do, end quote. If Canada proceeds and we do nothing, it will be game over for the climate. Before the hour, this hour, as all three tonight, is being sponsored by Sam McKee. This hour, Scott Ainsley, songwriter, musician, philosopher. His music will please your ears as well as open your heart and your eyes. Sam would like you to listen to Scott Ainsley's music. If you're listening online, just as we were coming back, that last tune was one of Scott Ainsley's. We're playing his music for our internet audience tonight. Beautiful stuff. Go to his website, cattailmusic.com, check him out, and get the free download of his song, Don't Obey, cattailmusic.com. And he closes by saying, sometimes Michael makes me laugh really hard with his notorious wit and macabre humor as he launches volley after volley of venom at the vitriolic varieties of facile fascists and right-wing nincompoops. Good times, right? Thanks, Sam. Sam McKee. James Hansen writes that Canada's tar sands, deposits of sand saturated by bitumen, contain twice the amount of carbon dioxide emitted by global oil use in our entire history. Woo! If we were to fully exploit this new source of oil and continue to burn our conventional oil, gas, and coal supplies, concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere eventually would reach levels higher than in the Pliocene era, more than 2.5 million years ago. Pliocene, tomato, tomato, when sea level was at least 50 feet higher than it is now. That level of heat-trapping gases would assure that the disintegration of the ice sheets would accelerate out of control. Sea levels would rise and destroy coastal cities. Global temperatures would become intolerable. 20 to 50% of the planet's species would be driven to extinction. Civilization would be at risk. I'm sorry. Now, keep in mind, this guy is an esteemed scientist. Anyway, he says that is the long-term outlook. Near-term, things will be bad enough. Over the next several decades, the western United States and the semi-arid region from North Dakota to Texas will develop semi-permanent drought, with rain when it does come occurring in extreme events with heavy flooding. Economic losses would be incalculable. More and more, the Midwest would be a dust bowl. California's Central Valley could no longer be irrigated. Food prices would rise to unprecedented levels. If this sounds apocalyptic, it is. This is why we need to reduce emissions dramatically. President Obama has the power not only to deny tar sands oil additional access to Gulf Coast refining, which Canada desires in part for export markets, but also to encourage economic incentives to leave tar sands and other dirty fuels in the ground. The global warming signal is now louder than the noise of random weather, as I predicted would happen by now in the journal Science in 1981. Extremely hot summers have increased noticeably. We can say with high confidence that the recent heat waves in Texas and Russia and the one in Europe in 2003, which killed tens of thousands, were not natural events. They were caused by human-induced climate change. We have known since the 1800s that carbon dioxide traps heat in the atmosphere. The right amount keeps the climate conducive to human life. But add too much, as we are doing now, and temperatures will inevitably rise too high. We need to start reducing emissions significantly, not create new ways to increase them. We should impose a gradually rising carbon fee. And then he goes on to explain an economic way to handle this. He concludes by saying President Obama speaks of a planet in peril, but he does not provide the leadership needed to change the world's course. Our leaders must speak candidly to the public, explaining that our continued technological leadership and economic well-being demand a reasoned change of our energy course. History has shown that the American public can rise to the challenge, but leadership is essential. The science of the situation is clear. It's time for the politics to follow. The cost of acting goes far higher the longer we wait. We can't wait any longer to avoid the worst and be judged immoral by coming generations. James Hansen, you can find this at NewYorkTimes.com, or if you subscribe to the paper, there it is. Wow, the fun, lighthearted Malloy program. Oh, my God. Yes, we get together around the campfire every night and figure out ways to scare the hell out of ourselves by telling each other the truth. I liked it better when I used to go to YMCA camp, and we would sit around the campfire at night and tell each other stories about Mona. That was a woman who lived at the bottom of the lake over there, Lake Stoney. Mona, you see, had been a local farm girl, and she had had a very bad experience with a threshing machine. And the camp was built on what used to be the family farm. So Mona didn't like that. She lived in the bottom of the lake. And she would come out at night and creep around after all the campers were asleep. She'd come up on the porch of your cabin, and you could hear her. And sometimes, it was said, she had come into cabins and would steal campers. other times she would just walk away, and you knew it was her because when you got up in the morning, you could see the weeds from the lake on your front porch. I liked that kind of scary stories around the campfire a hell of a lot better than the ones I've been telling. All right, I have a postscript to church night. Oh, do I ever. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Seven past the hour. A couple emails here from yesterday from Edie in Atlanta. Mike, I just want to say that if what Obama said about gay marriage prevents one confused, tormented young person from killing himself or herself, history will call Obama great. From Edie in Atlanta. And as sort of a counter position to that, from Sand, Mike, if we wish to see millions in the streets, you know, the idea of massive peaceful protest. If we wish to see millions in the streets, then Romney must win. I switched to independent last year and will vote Green Party across the ballot. I'm not going to waste my vote on the phony Democrats, most of whom support the military-industrial complex rather than the population of this country. Little by little, okay, one more time. Little by little, I have given up on so-called left-wing shows. Hartman, Schultz, Press, Miller, and Maddow on MSNBC. It seems she has turned pro-war as well. I cannot take the Obama apologist any longer. To me, he's a baby killer, an earth destroyer, and a shredder of the Constitution. So I'm crossing my fingers for a Republican win. So, go ahead, damn me to hell. LOL. Have a wonderful weekend. Peace and love. Sand. All righty then. Jeff in L.A., when I was struggling last night to remember Malloy socialism, you know, what the hell it constituted. That's really something when you come up with of course, my idea is nothing more, I don't think, than Scandinavian or Swedish socialism, but it's applicable, I think, more so in this country. Anyway, Jeff in L.A. sent it to me. Included in Malloy social democratic socialism, included but not limited to the industries that should be publicly owned: banking, education, transportation, healthcare, communications, and weaponry. Weaponry is especially important because by public ownership of the weapons industry, we eventually can strangle it, kill it, murder it, bury it, and get rid of it. And if we are, you know, if citizens of the United States need to feel paranoid to some degree because we live in a predatory world and we don't have the time or the inclination to solve that predatory attitude by understanding, then keep the nukes. Keep the nukes. Yeah. Okay, what else here? Oh, and Ricky in San Leandro, regarding the F-22 fighter, fighter jet that was featured on one of the segments on 60 Minutes on Sunday night, Rick writes, callers should have informed you of a glaring omission in the 60 Minutes report on the F-22 Raptor's equipment problem with oxygen for its pilots. 60 Minutes characterized the conflict as that of the Air Force Command being callous and forcing its own, or the state's Air National Guard fighter jets pilots, to continue flying while they, the Air Force, continue to be at a loss over how flyers are suffering oxygen deprivation. One glaring omission was the story made not one mention of the manufacturer or mention that the military plane even has a private sector manufacturer. Not only did the broadcast not make a single hint at the identity of the builder, the story also made it sound like the cause of the problem was strictly a mystery, confined solely to the military. Nothing was said either about any actual deaths that which could possibly be attributed to the defect. I would be unsurprised were we to learn that CBS Television News may have gotten threats or bribes to put a gag on discussing or disclosing the role of Lockheed Martin. I would venture a guess that this defense contractor does possess knowledge on what the cause is and how to solve it. Like other corporations' executives, this one's must be covering things up both internally in the company and externally in the military brass, the civilian government, and the news networks. The editing by omission of the elephant in the room for the story's broadcast was so blatant that it is shameful. Well, thanks, Rick. No, I had not seen the segment, nor the program in its entirety, but that's an excellent point. If 60 Minutes did not even mention that it was Lockheed Martin, oh, God, don't you get tired of it, True Seeker? Do you ever get really, 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 really tired of it all? And just long for change that apparently is never going to come, not until we're motivated to bring about change. From a Purple Cart, Fukushima Reports is the subject line. Purple Cart writes, what makes me shake my head is the outrage you have received over the Fukushima reports. The information appears to be legitimate and of concern to whatever degree. Do the people that are barking have any knowledge or concern over the many power plants in this country that are leaking? Do they have any knowledge or concern over the fracking that is polluting our rivers and streams? I stopped going into a panic over these things a long time ago. It is what it is, and the people don't seem to want to get off the couch. The response to 9/11 told me the majority do not want to deal with reality. There will be something at some point that will make people realize how entrenched the military and the corporations are. And Purple Cart's point, of course, is that, you know, I've said that I have gotten emails from people who not necessarily dispute the facts of Fukushima, but dispute the potential for global disaster, that somehow there is not enough damage at Fukushima to bring about what some are predicting. The problem for me is that those who are predicting what could possibly be the worst nuclear event this planet has ever faced, those people pointing it out are people who seem to be knowledgeable about what they're saying. They are Japanese, and let's keep in mind, as far as the Japanese are concerned, nobody on Earth, no other group of people, society, culture, nation, has had the direct experience of dealing with nuclear disaster as the Japanese have. Granted, it was 60 years ago, that doesn't make any difference. They know. And because of that, I am sure that the Japanese studied very judiciously, very thoroughly, as they, you know, the whole structure of nuclear reactors as they built their country into a country that relied on nuclear production of power to the degree that it did. And by the way, the Japanese have closed every single nuclear plant. I understand that last week, there was a day last week when the last operating nuclear plant was shut down. And the predictions are that Japan will now experience a decline in industrial production, a decline in its position as one of the leading manufacturing or technological societies on Earth. This hour, by the way, is being sponsored by Sam McKee. His message? Scott Ainsley channels Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues Singers, Dust My Broom, Phonograph Blues, and more. He performs in Lomax, Mississippi. He performs Lomax, Mississippi, John Hurt, and other blues greats, as well as his own original tunes. Go to cattailmusic.com, cattailmusic.com, to learn more. Enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey, cattailmusic, one word, .com. All 3 hours sponsored by Sam in L.A. tonight, supporting our friends and the pursuit of justice in spite of its inherent dangers. Courage, all, and occupy!
All sub dry, down to the very last breath. Bartender, what is wrong with me? Why am I so out of breath? The captain said, excuse me, ma'am, the species has amused itself to death.
Speakers, it'll be our secret.
21 past the hour. You know, we talk about religious bigotry and the insanity of religion and how it poisons human relationships. It poisons, literally poisons the planet. It literally poisons people's attitudes, mental processes. Religion, really, when you look at it, step back a few feet and look at it. Forget about your massive fear of death and all this other crap and just take a look at it. You have to come to the conclusion, you really do, if you are still sane, that one of the most destructive forces ever unleashed on this planet, whether it's genetic or not, I really don't care, is religion. It is something that should have been eliminated from the human psyche so long ago, but it has not, and it seems to be getting even more deeply entrenched, like a parasite that is burrowed all the way down to the bone marrow and keeps going. One of the latest examples of this was on the front page of the Times this morning about the ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York City who are punishing, as only they can, members of their own ultra-Orthodox sect, and there are several of them, who have the temerity to complain when their children are molested, sexually violated, in the same manner that Catholic priests violate children, rabbis and Orthodox Jews who are associated with the children also do the same thing. And the Times uses a couple examples of actual people. Here's one. Mordecai Jungreis learned that his mentally disabled teenage son was being molested in a Jewish ritual bathhouse in Brooklyn. Mr. Jungreis complained. The man accused of the abuse was arrested. And what happened next is the crux of this report in the Times. Old friends started walking stonily past him and his family on the streets of Williamsburg. Their landlord kicked them out of their apartment. Anonymous messages filled their answering machine, cursing Mr. Jungreis for turning in a fellow Jew. And he said the mother of a child in a wheelchair confronted his mother-in-law, saying that the same man had molested her son, and, quote, she did not report this crime, so why did your son-in-law have to, end quote. This curse of silence in the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community is just now starting to be getting the kind of publicity that it should have been gotten, the same kind of publicity that the Catholic Church received from its violent attack against children. But by cooperating with the police and speaking out about his son's abuse, Mr. Jungreis found himself At the forefront, the Times says, of an issue roiling his insular Hasidic community, those who come forward encounter intense intimidation from their neighbors and from rabbinical authorities. And all the pressure, all the insults is aimed at pressuring them to drop their cases. The Orthodox Jews feel that it's nobody's business if children are being sexually violated. It's nobody's business. Abuse victims and their families, according to the Times, have been expelled from religious schools and synagogues, shunned by fellow ultra-Orthodox Jews, targeted for harassment, intended to destroy their businesses. Now, what's this about? This is because they have complained that their children are being raped by other Orthodox Jews, not outsiders. Their children are being sexually assaulted. And they complain to the lawful authorities. And then they, the victims, are treated like dirt in this community. Mr. Jungreis said, try living for one day with all the pain I am living with. Did anybody, he asks, in the Hasidic community in these 2 years, in Brewer Park, in Flatbush, ever come up and look my son in the eye and tell him a good word? Did anybody take the courage to show him mercy in the street? And, of course, the answers are no. Another example, Pearl Engelman, 64-year-old great-grandmother, said her community had failed her, too. In 2008, her son, Joel, told rabbinical authorities that he had been repeatedly molested as a child by a school official at the United Talmudical Academy in Williamsburg. The school briefly removed the official, but denied the accusation. And when the boy turned 23, too old to file charges under the state statute of limitations, the Talmudical Academy in Williamsburg returned the man to teaching. What does that sound like? Doesn't that sound like the Catholic Church? Doesn't that sound like what the bishops and the bishops have done? Shifting child molesting priests around, and now it's in the Hasidic community, or perhaps it always has been. Mrs. Engelman said, quote, there's no nice way of saying it. Our community protects molesters. Other than that, we are wonderful. Our community protects molesters. And there's more here that I want to talk about after the break. When you take a look at the outcry against what Obama said yesterday as president, that he supported same-sex marriage. And I know. He should have said it a long time ago. Struggling, as he said, with, his evolving on the issue. He says it. You're going to believe it. You don't believe it or don't believe it. But I think most people of his age have already settled their mind. And I don't think it took 2 years for him to make a personal decision. It took 2 years for him to make a political decision, yes, but not a personal decision. But his hesitation was because of the religious, insane bigotry and hatred that exists in this country. Insane, religious, putrefying hatred. I wonder when we're going to get enough of it.
It's Mike Malone.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Sam McKee, as is the entire evening. Thanks, Sam. His message this hour, Scott Ainsley channels Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues Singers, with Dust My Broom, Phonograph Blues, and more. He performs Lomax, Mississippi, John Hurt, and other blues greats, as well as his own original tunes. Now, you can get this. Go to cattailmusic.com. Cattail. It's one word. Cattailmusic.com to learn more. Enjoy the free download of his song, Don't Obey. Cattailmusic.com. All 3 hours sponsored by Sam in L.A. tonight, supporting our friends in the pursuit of justice in spite of its inherent dangers. encourage all and occupy. Thanks, Sam. So back to the ultra-Orthodox Hasidim, Lubavitcher communities, ultra-Orthodox Jews in New York who when they discover, and they don't want to know this, that one of their children or 10 of their children or hundreds of their children are being molested within their community, sexually violated in the same manner as Catholic priests violate little Catholic children. The ultra-Orthodox Jews, there are instances, many instances, of them doing the same thing. The reaction is pretty much the same. Keep it within the religious stricture. You know, the children are having their minds utterly and absolutely destroyed, whether it's Catholic or Jew. But no matter. What is more important is their filthy, perverted religions. All of these people, Christian, Jew, Muslim, I don't care who it is. It makes no difference. When you take a look at the poison that religion has pumped and continues to pump into any culture that has to deal with it, it's horrifying. Now, the Times reports on this. New York City area is home to an estimated 250,000 ultra-Orthodox Jews, and the largest community is in Brooklyn, where many of the Hasidim live. They are followers of a fervent spiritual movement that began in 18th century Europe and applies Jewish law to every aspect of life. Everything. Their communities are headed by dynastic leaders called Rebbes. They strive to preserve their centuries-old custom by resisting the contaminating influences of the outside world. Contaminating influences. The attitude around this issue for Catholic and Jews seems to be, don't contaminate us, let us continue to anally rape our little boys and vaginally rape our little girls. Don't contaminate us with your laws. Now, how sick is that? How sick is that? They adhere to an ancient prohibition against Messira, the turning in of a Jew to non-Jewish authorities. And they consider publicly airing their allegations against fellow Jews to be Chilul Hashem, a desecration of God's name. If you report outside of their cult that your child has been anally raped, you are guilty of a desecration of God's name. Think about that for a second. Truth seeker, how perverted is that? Also, rabbinical authorities worry that inviting outside scrutiny could erode their power. It's according to Samuel Heilman, who's a professor of Jewish studies at Queens College. He says, quote, they are more afraid of the outside world than the deviants within their own community. The deviants threaten individuals here or there, but the outside world threatens everyone and the entire structure of their world. End quote. Is that true? Or is this more religious, insane paranoia? Doesn't every religion have the same kind of paranoid attitude? Oh, well, you know. Look at the, what are the groups in Pennsylvania? Not Mennonites, but the Amish. And some of those German-derived religions that came to this country. They have the same attitude. Religion. Good God. Rabbi Chaim Dovid Zweibel, Executive Vice President of Agadath Israel of America. That's a powerful ultra-Orthodox organization, which last year said that observant Jews should not report allegations of child rape to the police unless permitted to do so by a rabbi. He says, quote, you can destroy a person's life with a false report, end quote. Well, that's very true. You could also destroy a child's life with repeated anal rape, wouldn't you say, Rabbi? And according to the Times, Rabbi Zweibel said, we recommend you speak it over with a rabbi before coming to any definitive conclusion in your own mind. This is about the rape of your child. Talk to a rabbi before you come to a definitive conclusion in your mind. Would you do that, truth seeker? Now, I'm assuming you're not an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I'm assuming you're not a child-molesting Catholic priest. I'm assuming you're partially rational. Are you? I don't know. I don't know who listens to this program. But if your child is raped, if your little boy, your little girl is raped by a minister, a priest, a rabbi, an imam, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Are you gonna go to somebody within that horrific institution, whatever your religion is, and say, listen, let's chat. My 6-year-old was anally raped. Let's chat because, you know, he's home bleeding and I'm not sure what to do. What should I do? What should I do, rabbi, priest, imam, minister? What should I do? This is religion. It goes on and on and on. If you want to read it, go read it yourself. New York Times this morning, today, what a sickening, disgusting, filthy, horrific article. It just never stops, huh? Religion. Bigotry. Poison. Hatred. Division. Even Obama, he made fessing up to the fact that he's made his transition now. He's finally, after giving it lots of thought, dear God, he's finally come to the conclusion that he thinks same-sex couples should be able to get married. His evolution apparently is complete. He said that the reason he had a problem with it was because of religion, people's religious beliefs. Of course. If there were none of these perverted religions, the ones that have caused such poison in this society, if they were not here, do you think there would be any issue at all about whether or not to report someone and punish them severely for anally raping a child? Do you think there would be any discussion at all about two people forming a marriage contract? In these two instances, we're talking only about the structure of the religion that says, no. I'm sorry, you're going to have to suffer. The Christians, the Catholics would tell you about suffering. Well, suffering is ennobling. Yeah, you know, Jesus suffered on the cross, so you're supposed to suffer. You have cancer? Well, it's eating you alive? Well, okay. But Jesus, that happened to Jesus. So science should stay out of the way. Cure for cancer? No, suffer! Isn't that wonderful? Your child is assaulted, raped, attacked by someone whom the child believes to be a personification of, if not God, certainly ecclesiastical authority. What's a 7, 8, 9-year-old going to do? Mommy, the priest raped me. Daddy, the rabbi fondled my genitals. What's the child going to do? If the child does have the courage to approach a parent, then what's the parent to do? Oh, I know, I reported the priest. And then what? Nothing. Well, I know, I'll report it to the rabbinical council. Then what? Nothing. And God literally damn you in the Hasidic, in the ultra-Orthodox community, if you step outside that community to seek justice for your raped child. Nice. Huh? No, it's not nice. Religious bigotry, division, meanness, poverty of spirit, hate. My God is better than your God, and I will cut your goddamn throat to prove it. Well, my God is better than your God, and I'll lop your head off to prove it. It goes on and on and on. President Obama's moment is how the Times in lead editorial today put it. President Obama's moment, really? Why didn't he, you know, when he said it should be up to the states, Why doesn't he remember that in 1967 the Supreme Court said that no state could prohibit mixed-race marriages because, quote, marriage is one of the basic civil rights of man, humans, end quote. So if mixed-race marriages cannot be prohibited because marriage is one of the basic civil rights of man, then how can Obama dignify religious strictures against same-sex marriage? How can he do that? It's poison. It's absolute poison.
I never had my hand between that young boy's thighs. I'm with the God Squad, so listen good. Hear my battle cry down in Hollywood. I'm with the God Squad. There's no place to run. I'm paving the way to King.
Before the hour, this night has been sponsored by Sam McKee. And his message this hour, Scott Ainsley channels Robert Johnson, King of the Delta Blues Singers, with Dust My Broom, Phonograph Blues, and more. He performs Lomax, Mississippi, John Hurt, and other blues greats, as well as his own original tunes. Go to cattailmusic.com, cattailmusic.com to learn more. Enjoy the free download of this song, of his song, titled Don't Obey. You got to hear it. Cattailmusic.com. All 3 hours tonight have been sponsored by Sam in L.A., offering support for our friends and the pursuit of justice in spite of its inherent dangers. Courage, all. And occupy. Thank you, Sam. Thank you very, very much for the sponsorship all night tonight. Tom in 29 Palms, California, he wrote in the other night about religious bigotry, but excuse me, this regarding what we're talking about tonight or last night about the Crouches, he writes, "Hi, Mike, that's it. It's who they are. They take possession of everything. Because they themselves are so damn possessed by every unconscious, perverted, emotional delusion knowable to their brute, ignorant, greedy natures. They take away our health care and then sell it back for their profits. They take our education and then sell it back for their gain. They take our peace and sell it back as war. They even sell us their money as interest and then take our homes, our children, and our futures. They are the enemy of the Union, and they seek to impose their theocracy in lieu of democracy in order to show themselves and the world how powerful they are by killing it all forever. Death will prove their Bible's validity, and nobody will be alive to differ. It's their totalitarianism to the extreme. They are necrophiliacs who worship dead gods, death in heaven, death through deprivation and war. Life is their defeat. Let's outvote them, outstyle them, unseat them, and outlive them." Tom in 29 Palms, California. Thanks, Tom. You know, when I was younger and ignorant, well, more ignorant than I am now, I'm still ignorant, but I mean more ignorant than I am now. My views of religion and God worship and all this stuff were decidedly mixed. You know, I would, like most kids, I guess, I would fluctuate between God as a vicious, violent, abusive parent and God as Santa Claus. And, somewhere in there would be, the feeling I had that I was being watched, you know, all the time. I was being watched physically. My thoughts were being invaded, kind of like, you know, the government now under Bush and Obama, where you have some sort of intrusion into everything that you do, think, feel, smell, eat, taste, conceive. But the older I got and started to study occasionally comparative religions and compared their death myths and their birth myths and their creation myths and found out that they were essentially all the same, that they are all derivative. The three religions of the book are strictly derivative. They are not original. They have nothing to do with some original thought by a group of or a tribe of desert dwellers 7,000 years ago, or a breakaway from that tribe 2,000 years ago, or a breakaway from that tribe 1,400 years ago. It's all the same, every single bit of it. Eastern, Western, it doesn't make any difference. And it's all designed, I came to realize, it's all designed for one purpose only, control. Control and the accumulation of power. That's it. The state now is in a death struggle, obviously, with religion. This nonsense between separation of church and state. It's separation of religion and state, and they're both in a death struggle for ultimate control. Some of the more nastier religions have gotten the idea, well, it's very simple. We just, let's try to control the state, and then we don't have a problem. And, of course, conversely, communist countries had it the other way. Let's control religion, and we won't have any problem. But they're both in a death struggle. And in this country, that struggle is so obvious. It is just so obvious. And each, the corporate state, the secular state, the capitalist state uses religion in order to control the masses. The church hasn't figured out yet, or religion hasn't figured out yet, exactly how to use the corporate state to control, except in its blessings. When you look at the, go online and Google, Pope Nazis or Catholic priest Nazis and take a look at the volumes of pictures that will be at your fingertips, and you realize the hideous alignment that the Catholic Church in Europe made with the Nazis. And of course they had their reasons, the church did. It was a quick way to get rid of the killers of Christ. Here, execute these 6 million. Ooh, are you finished? Oh great, thank you, Mr. Hitler. That sort of thing. So, it's one of the ongoing, I'm sorry if it offends you, but that's just too bad. If it offends you, don't listen to this program. But it's one of the ongoing themes of this program is the hideous, horrific, terrifying, anti-life attitudes of religion. Anti-joy. Anti-freedom. Anti-everything. Control. Dominance. Well, again, the French philosopher Denis Diderot, man will never be free until the last king is strangled with the entrails of the last priest. And remember, anyone who has the power to make you believe absurdities has the power to make you commit atrocities. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.